Today's date is August 18th, 1997. The speaker is Dwayne Addison. The topic is Biblical Prophets for Today, Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9, an introduction to our approach and concerns. This is one of 10.
Lord God, creator of all things, who are present in our midst and present in the suffering of the world, tune our ears, focus our eyes, sharpen our minds, that we may hear and see and understand your voice. Amen. Roll the tape. This is all being recorded in your voice as well. And I said that I can wander anywhere else. I don't sit down and I don't ever use the podium. So I hope they said they can pick me up here. I am Dwayne Addison. I'm a Lutheran pastor, college teacher, semi-retired at the moment. I taught for, I was a campus pastor at the University of Iowa, University of Minnesota a bit before that. Taught for 26 years at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, and have retired, but now in Minneapolis area, and I'm teaching part-time at Augsburg College there. And I'm frustrated because there is no course on the prophets offered there, and that is one of the great failures of Augustana College. In a moment, I want to give you a story that explains a bit of my passion and concern that's here before we open up into the day's concerns. I was trained in the field of Christian ethics, and particularly in public policy, and so I've come at it from that direction. In college, I was primarily a teacher of Bible as well as Christian ethics. I began very early after moving to South Dakota to become fascinated with personal contacts with Native American or the Sioux people, the Lakota people of the Dakotas. And so most of my professional career has been dealt with the concerns of American Indian people, particularly of the Plains. I began with their justice issues, but finally, my great enthusiasm and concern, one of them, was with the spirituality, the power of their own religious tradition. And then because of that, I began to team a teacher of world religions, and so much of my teaching deals with world religions for adult education audiences, and also particularly with the challenge of Islam in our midst. And so that's a wide field. But one could say everything that I teach is sort of a footnote on the prophets. As introduced by Abraham Joshua Heschel. And I just say Heschel from here on in. A story. I first became acquainted with Heschel during the Vietnam days. I was a campus pastor at the University of Iowa. The students had already moved over here to saw there's something deeply wrong with the American involvement in Southeast Asia. And at that time, I began reading some things, and I read a little essay about the moral meaning of Vietnam by Abraham Heschel, just a short essay. And that was my first introduction to him. I'd heard about him, I knew about him, no stories about him. And that began a process that might change my whole attitude of American place in the war and the meaning of Vietnam, because his argument was in a theological, a fundamentally religious Jewish-Christian persuasion that began to be very persuasive. And therefore, I began to read other things that were by Heschel. And because of that involvement in the anti-war movement, I went with a group here. I'd already moved to Sioux Falls, South Dakota by then, of a gathering of people on that. And one of the speakers was Abraham Heschel. I said, oh, I'll hear this guy in person. And there was a great moment. And the pulpit of New York Avenue Presbyterian Church appeared this guy. He was in a robe, and I always picture him now as a robe. He has a long, flowing beard. And literally, he was luminous. The moment that he stepped into that pulpit, and then confirmed by what he said, this was an actual prophetic voice that was there, that talked in the passion of the prophets and the language of the prophets of what was going on in our country. And after that moment, I read everything I could find about Heschel and went on from the practical stuff. He has a book called God in Search of Man at the Philosophy of Judaism, or Man's Quest for God about prayer in the Jewish tradition. A book on the Sabbath that is just sort of marvelous for non-Jew people to read. But I had not read his book on the prophets, and so I was back at Augustana the next year, and the first volume of his book on the prophets came out in paperback. And I'm one of these people that usually waits for the paperback before I buy it. I mean, read it in the library, and then I get it, and I read that. And there's the first 30 pages of that book, introduction and a book chapter called What Manner of Man is the Prophet? I use inclusive language here, and Heschel did not, writing in the 60s. This was published in 62, but this is 69, the paperback came out. I read that first volume of his book, and my life was changed. It was one of the three books in my life that has sort of profoundly changed the direction of my life. And opened up the prophets. I already was interested in the prophets. This is my favorite course in the seminary. I went to Luther Seminary in St. Paul. And I read this, and right after I read this volume, I went to the head of the department, who especially was the prophets. And he said, I want to teach the department chair. I want to teach the course on the prophets. Because I'd read Heschel. Well, he was familiar with Heschel. And assigned it. Well, I want to do some other stuff in the Hebrew Bible. So go ahead, you'll teach it. And so for many years, not trained as an Old Testament scholar, I taught the course in the prophets at Augustana College. And it helped me to see the whole issue of ethics different, the whole issue of looking at the faith of other people differently, the whole understanding between Jewish community and the Christian community. But who I was in relationship to this God that Jewish and Christian people shared in common. And he opened up the prophets and opened up my life. And so I just want to pay back that debt and share a bit of that again. And since I've been frustrated not being teaching a prophet course at Augsburg, here is my chance to do it again. I often teach courses in Islam and other things, but the Church of the Prophets, but I'm glad they did, because here we are. Turn your Bibles to the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Bible, chapter 6, 4-9. This session will be dealing less with the text, and maybe that's the only one we'll look at with care, and I think, but in the other sessions we'll follow, we'll start, or in the middle of the end, do a careful study and an interactive conversation with the text itself, because it's the words of the prophets that I want you to become finding to deal with. We have different translations. I have the RSV, because that's my Oxford annotated Bible on that, and it has the sexist language, and it means people. It says man, and Heschel does the same thing. And so if you have a new RSV, it's sensitive to that. The first part of that. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And of course, when it's in caps like that, it refers to the covenant name of God, Yahweh. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be upon your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children. And then it continues on with specific instructions. What do you hear? What memories does that bring? What images does that bring when you hear these words? Perhaps the most important text in the Hebrew Bible. What connections?
Great commandment of Jesus.
Okay. What did Jesus say about these words?
The quote from the two greatest commandments, okay, which all the others are summed up.
The first half of the Great Commandment, or sometimes this one is simply referred to as the Great Commandment, but there's a second unlike unto it, taken from the book of Leviticus. To love your neighbor as yourself. All the teachings of the law, that is the Torah, and the prophets hang upon these words. The love of your Lord your God with all your... Well, I'll get the translation right here. Is that each one varies? With all your heart, that is the key word, with all your soul, and with all your might. Give other translations, these will vary. What else? Jesus' connection. Just a note on that, in Jesus' time, and in contemporary Judaism in most places, you have a body of law called the Halakha. This is the application of the Torah and the rules of living, and these are sort of developed and applied as well. And so there are 613 laws of the Halakha. And there's always debate, you see, with Jews, with the Pharisees, you know, which law applies here? And you had a sort of system of casuistry, a case sort of law that you would apply to that. And Jesus, like the other prophets before him, simplifies it. We'll talk about that when we deal with the prophet Micah. What God requires is simple to understand. To love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and might. And the other half of it, to love your neighbor as yourself. They are connected. All prophets are commentaries. Jewish word is midrash upon this text. There is no creed in Judaism, my Jewish friends tell. We don't have like you, we don't have creed, but this would be the nearest thing to it. So if you would go to a Jewish synagogue or temple on a Friday evening, depending on which Friday you'd go to, you would hear these words several times in Hebrew and or English. And so, you know, these are words similar to the Lord's Prayer. What is it called? Jewish?
Is it the Shema?
The Shema. Jewish word or Hebrew word that simply means listen, pay attention. And so that's sort of the word for that. Pay attention. This is clearly what God, Yahweh the Lord, requires. Love. In the book of Deuteronomy, the primary theme is love. Is love understood as heart-impassioned loyalty? But the term heart appears very often in Deuteronomy. Love, not in the romantic sense, but in the sense of sort of a steadfastness, of hanging on here, of giving yourself to that, and sort of the power here of that. It is no problem, because I think Jesus is the greatest of the prophets, and I'll come back to that. If you take what matter of the prophet, and what really struck me in one dimension of that, this is the most marvelous description of Jesus' ministry that I've ever seen, and Heschel was not even talking about Jesus. He hardly ever refers to him. But the man that Jesus is the great prophet. But to see that the biblical book to which Jesus refers to most, the one that's most shaped his own self-understanding, his own ministry, is the book of Deuteronomy. Not, as we would consider, a book of prophecy. It is a part of the Torah, or the Torah, the first part of the Hebrew Bible, we'll look at in a moment. And so, this is sort of the touchstone. Everything else the prophets say will, in a sense, be looking back. They'll talk about heart. I want to deal with that when I deal with the prophet Jeremiah. In a sense, the prophets are very conservative. At the same time, they're very radical. They talk continually of going back to the tradition of Moses, the original teaching, the way things were. At the same time, with that call for radical simplicity, to clear out the trash, to get to that simple sort of thing that God clearly intended to be a part of God's people. Those who hear the call of God must above all hear this. Hear, listen, Shema. I will not take today as I planned, because I want to talk about what manner of man is the prophet. And you'll see this here, I'll be back and forth before the dream these boards on that. When Heschel talks about the prophet, he talks about a kind of figure that appears in a very short period of Hebrew history. On that, a period of no more than 250 years, likely more than 200 years. We would call these the writing of the classical prophets. And Heschel has a, what he simply called about the prophet or the prophets, could refer to almost any one of these figures, as much as we know about them. Each one, of course, is individual, and this is why I do these individual courses on the topics that will have their own themes. And prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah will have a dozen strings on their bow on that, and some will just have one or two. But is this prophet? But prophecy is an ancient tradition in Israel. And that's the other text that was listed there. In the Jewish tradition, if you raise the question, the question, who is the prophet? What would the answer be? Would that be Isaiah? Would that be Amos? Obviously not Amos.
Elijah?
I want to come to that. The prophet would be, in the religious circles, would be Moses. So if you go among the Pharisees, there's no doubt that Moses was the vehicle by which God has spoken to us, and we have his words. But the other one that did, in the popular sense, you see, in Jesus' time, and for many reasons, because John the Baptist, Jesus points out, this is Elijah returned. This is Elijah that's in our midst. In the popular imagination, the prophet would be Elijah. And these are the other texts that I had here. I had a couple of samples that I would like to take, but we'll see if we have time on that. Elijah. Elijah has a nemesis, Jezebel, the most wicked woman of all scripture. I mean, Lady Macbeth is sort of a shadow of Jezebel on that. And she had a weak-kneed husband named Ahab. And Elijah was scared of his wits with Jezebel. I mean, she was mean. Well, I mean, she just sort of killed his compatriots, and they had a battle going on there. And this passage here is a part of the story of the combat with the prophets of Baal. This was the god of Jezebel, and Ahab, although he was Hebrew or Jewish, went along with that. And the confrontation with Elijah and that. And Elijah, of course, is so scared out of his wits that he flees Israel and goes down to Mount Sinai, to Horeb, you know, one of the names for Sinai, the two different traditions in it. And there he says, and he hides. I mean, he's going someplace that God would protect him there, and Jezebel would not get him down there. And then you know the story there that God comes in the storm and the wind and the fire and the earthquake. And but then God, how did God speak to Elijah?
Still small voice.
Still small voice, a quiet, gentle voice. And we look at that text as a but one of the things that Elijah had an ego the size of a football field, is that only I remain faithful to you, God. Everybody else would have scuttled the ship when I was out here, and I'm alone. I've been abandoned. And he reminds him, don't, you know, cut the crap. Elijah, I mean, they're a lot more like you out there. And he says, go back. And that's sort of the end of the story. He goes back here, and then he commissions Elijah, you know, not to be confused with Elijah, to continue the story. And so you have these great stories of Elijah that are there, of a prophet. When Elijah was there, you knew you had somebody to deal with. I mean, this guy on the surface was sort of a fearless, but terribly intimidated by a woman. And, you know, I guess this has been in many other places. And he needed God here to stand up here. But as most books would tell you, commentaries, that this was the primary battle, because at the heart of the prophet's concern all the way here was going after other gods would be unfaithfulness. Unfaithfulness, since usually imagine the terms of marital faithfulness, faithfulness between partners. That the greatest danger and the heart and the root of all evil here is you've lost that loyalty and love to Yahweh, to the God who brought your ancestors out of Egypt. And so we have a whole series of prophets, and their primary difference, of course, Moses stands by himself. We have that whole tradition of Moses, the stories and the teaching in the first five books of the Bible and the books of Moses. And then we have a series of prophets in which Elijah stands out. And what they failed is that they never had their stuff written down. We have stories about them. We have sort of snippets of their lesson. We know what their priorities and concerns were. We don't know anymore. We assume there's a lot more behind them. And tomorrow we'll start to the subject of Amos, and there are a number of others that are the two, men and women. There's some women prophets that are here. And tomorrow we'll take a look at Amos, and because Amos here was one of those prophets, again, that was sort of fearless, and he was thrown out of town. We don't hear about him anymore, but somebody recorded his words. Words, as in most prophets, are cast and very carefully constructed poetry. It is amazing. I mean, this is not ad hoc speaking. These were things that were in sort of the poetic condensers of the time, and rhyme and rhythm, and in the Hebrew language, and thought rhyme that would sort of be there. But Amos was probably killed or went in exile, went back. But we'll pick up his story tomorrow. But the point I want to make is, because he spoke out and was silenced, now the words of the prophets would be written form. almost always, with few exceptions, the biblical prophets whom we honor that are in our Bible were never honored or honored in their own time. Jesus is not alone at that point. I mean, he stands in the tradition of prophets in many ways. But the words were remembered, and a generation later, a century later, the words were proven to be true. And as Hebrew, as Heschel notes here, some of the most disturbing people who have ever lived, their inspiration brought the Bible into being. Humanly speaking, perhaps divinely speaking, it's because here of the sense in Moses, but in these people as well, God has spoken directly to God's people. And these began, now we have the words of the prophets. And the Hebrew people became a people of the book. And because of that, Christians and all the Muslims are also people of the book. That we find our source, our touchstone in text. But first of all, those words, that message came in spoken form. And here, because it's after the prophets that the scriptures as we know them took their shape into the Bible. The Bible wasn't there at the beginning, it sort of grew. And if Heschel is right, and I think he is, it is the place of the prophets, the phenomenon of the prophets, the reality of the prophets that brought that into being. Let me shift. Two things I want to do here, and interrupt me along the way because I'll begin to roll and you have to weigh me down. Some stuff is familiar to some of you, very familiar, some casually familiar, but I want to put this as background. To put the writing prophets, the prophet that Heschel talks about and we'll look at in their place. First of all, to do this, and sort of a part of the motto or the aim, mission statement of Holman, is to celebrate in the life of the church God's reign of peace, justice, and wholeness. And that's sort of a capital phrase of what the prophets are about. And they do it more directly and more powerfully than I think anybody else. And so I think this really fits the Holden scene. But to move on, the Hebrew scriptures, as some of you know, these are ordered differently. The Hebrew scriptures have exactly the same content as most of our Protestant Bibles. The same books, but they're ordered differently. And there's some clues here on how to understand and deal with the prophets, but also some complications. There are three parts to the Hebrew scriptures. You'll find them today, and if it was in Hebrew, it'd go from, you know, the back to the front, but we do that. And they're ranked in their order of importance. First in importance, of course, is the Torah, or the Torah, or the law, we would call it, which is a bad name for that, because it's not law as we understood it, or the books of Moses. Even though the book of Deuteronomy talks about the death of Moses, and the last passage that was on the list here of I think it's chapter 34, looking back, there's not been a prophet like Moses that has risen since. And deep within that story, there's a longing for another Moses to come, another prophet. And the texts that I have sort of listed for today are all part of that. Once again, for example, when Samuel comes, prophecy begins as an act of tradition. There's a whole period of time, the story says, when there were no prophets from God, Moses has spoken, and it's understood that Moses had promised another one like him to come. Then you have Samuel and a series of other voices that are there. And so the prophetic witness is alive but not recorded in the sense of a book, beginning with the figure of Samuel. Samuel is interesting because Samuel is one of those transitional figures, a very powerful figure for the religious figure. He is a judge, where we would translate that term hero. My wife just and I just saw Samson and Delilah, you know, the opera. And Samson is one of these judges, that a hero that God, but a charismatic figure that God brings up to save people. He was that, but all of a sudden the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Samuel. And the prophetic tradition comes alive again and will operate for centuries. And so in a sense, even before 760, well before that, you have these prophetic figures that we only have glimpses of, men and women. That claimed to speak on behalf of God, and the people sort of, some of the people anyway, recognized it were there, but back for a thing. The most important books from the Jewish perspective are the Torah. But interestingly, among them, there's probably the most prophetic book of all, the book of Deuteronomy. It is cast in the form of farewell messages from Moses to the people as they're about to leave the wilderness and to enter into the promised land. These are the things that they are to remember, that they are to be a people of God. And it said this is the book that has more shaped Jesus' ministry than any other book. And we know, if you take the scholarship seriously, the book of Deuteronomy was edited and takes its form after the emphasis of these prophets, although its roots here are clearly back to Moses. The second one, and this is where most of our attention will be in the next session that we'll have, is simply called the prophets in the Hebrew Bible. But it's different than our section, the end of our Old Testament, we have the prophets. And, you know, and interesting enough that part of them are in the same order there. But what is interesting, you have the former prophets. Four scrolls that are not prophets in our sense, but I think in a accurately, it's proper to call them prophets. Joshua, Judges, 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. Four scrolls in the Hebrew Bible. And so, you know, the length of the scroll determines the book in most cases. These are stories told from the perspective of Deuteronomy. The message of Deuteronomy, in one sense, is very simple. If you are faithful to God and don't go after other gods and obey my commands, you will prosper in the land. If you are unfaithful, if you forget these commands, then destruction will come. A conditional prophecy. And all four of those books, particularly Samuel and Kings, are written here. They're marvelous literature. They're being filled with some of the great stories of the whole Western world in there. But they're most important, they are preaching. They're prophecy. They're holding up conduct and interpreting here the conduct of the people against the judgment and the expectations of God. I list them here because they're also prophetic in that sense, although told in story form, but they have the story of Samuel, Elijah, and a host of other prophets. And the prophets are the heroes of these stories until we come to David. David is the great hero of 2 Samuel, or we call it the Book of David on that. But if I could take another text, the prophet Nathan. You know that story when Nathan confronts David, and you know David gets the hots for Bathsheba here and sends off her husband off to the front lines to be killed, and then, you know, takes his wife and here he is the king and can do anything he wants. But Nathan comes to, you know, and tells him the little story of the guy that had this little gentle ewe lamb there, and a guest came for the person and he stole that lamb because he had the power to do it. And if you remember that story, that when Nathan, one of the last prophets that got a good hearing in front of the king, by the way, he came in and David said, that man ought to die. He has violated the fundamental reality of what it means to be a person of Yahweh's community. And what does Nathan say to the prophet?
It's you.
You're the man. David repented. Our text say that some of the great psalms, like Psalm 51, are part of that. And he suffered tremendous punishment, but his kingdom was allowed to survive. And there you have that interaction, because most of the prophets, that interaction was the rulers. And most of these were unhappy encounters, but this is one. And so that'd be another whole set of the things, these sort of great sort of sagas and marvelous literature stories. But then what we'll focus upon is the latter prophets. Prophets as we understand them. And they're organized somewhat, four great scrolls again. Isaiah, which is really at least three different sort of prophecies that share some common themes and priorities. And we'll take two looks at that. The Isaiah that speaks out of Jerusalem in the 8th century, later on this week, in terms of literature and power and beauty, without parallel. And the only competitor he has is the woman, I think, who writes Isaiah 40 to 55 here, that writes out of captivity in Babylon, sharing in that same tradition. And so we'll take two looks at Isaiah. Jeremiah, I was telling the gentleman who was doing the tapes here, I would like to do a couple weeks at Jeremiah, because this is the guy that has it all. Jeremiah has a bad rap. And it is not surprising that pious Jewish people, or ordinary Jewish people, when Jesus was around, that's Jeremiah that's come back. And they thought Jeremiah and Jesus had something in common. And we will see why that is the case. And this is one of the prophets with many, many strings on the bow, on the instrument. I'm going to take one. He is preeminently the prophet of the heart, the inwardness of the human person, and above all, the inwardness of God. But more of that. Ezekiel, the strangest of the prophets, and that will be fun. I'm going to talk about him in terms of the theme of resurrection, because Ezekiel witnesses the death of the nation. In the midst of the death, he sees the text that we'll look at, the valley of the dry bones. The placed bones upon the hillside of the destruction of the people, God will put flesh upon them, but above all, like Jeremiah says, he will put heart, and the nation was destroyed. And that's one of the greatest prophecies of all scripture, and one that has been fulfilled. And prophecies are fulfilled in strange ways. Most prophecies, by the way, are not fulfilled. Then we'll talk more about that. And then the fourth roll here, I'm sorry to say, it's simply called the 12 in the Hebrew Bible. The same 12 books we have at the very end of our Old Testament. We call them the minor prophets, which was not true. I mean, these are some of the great voices. Their works have to be sort of short. We'll take a look at three, not the order in which they come, Hosea, Amos, and Micah. And we'll spend the session and with the text of each of them. And so this will be the heart of our concern. And then the third part of the Hebrew Bible is called the Writings. And the collection of miscellaneous things in the New Testament, it refers to it, and also in the Jewish tradition, as the Psalms, because the primary book in that section of the Hebrew Bible is the book of Psalms, the hymn book. Really, that's what it is. It's the hymn book of the Second Temple that has come down to be the universal hymn book of Jewish and Christian people. Books of scrolls that deal with ceremonies and little stories that are there. But it also includes another prophet that does not fit into Heschel's categories, a very different prophet called Daniel. One of the latest books of the Bible to be written, a very different style. We'll talk about Daniel in terms of what is your round and then about apocalyptic. The prophet of visions, strange visions indeed. And sort of a model, one of the few that we have in the Old Testament, of a very different kind of prophecy. It'll share some concern, but his style will be different. And very important for the understanding of the New Testament as well. Within this, that short period of 200, 250 years, appeared, Heschel reminds us, of some of the amazing people that have appeared on the face of the earth. A footnote, I teach world religions. For some reason, Karl Jasper, the German philosopher, says he calls this an actual age because at that same time that the great Hebrew prophets were doing their thing, there were movements of renewal and change at several different centers of the world. And what sense do we make of that? Well, there's great periods of time with the outpouring of renewal and attention to divine power and human conduct that has not been equaled except in few times. But we're just looking at the Hebrew and the Christian version of that sort of period. And so, for these people, Heschel will often speak about the prophets are simply the prophets. A number of things that they share in common. They have common themes. I'd like to take in each one of them when we talk about justice. They do it in terms of Amos, but every one of these great prophets put justice or justice slash righteousness as a primary concern. Most of them spoke about heart, the inwardness, about love, a special kind of love. Most of their words are angry words. I talked to several people here and said, do so the course of the prophets, and the prophets are not popular chorus. This would not be Robert Schuller sort of stuff on that. Over 90% of the prophets are bad news, and we like good news. But one of the things that Heschel says, and I am persuaded against a number of other scholars at that point, that the prophets begin with bad news, and everyone, he says, ends with good news, with the message of hope and redemption. We'll come to that. This is the part of the larger scene that some of you will be around, because I teach the prophets in that historical framework and divide the prophets of those that lead up to the destruction of the people at Jerusalem in 587 before the Christian era on that, in which everything was destroyed. Their leadership, their temple, the leaders were carted off to Babylon, and everything was destroyed. And you have Ezekiel and Jeremiah who preach in those sorts of times. And Jeremiah, perhaps the angriest and most painful prophet of all, is a sweet singer of hope. Now there is hope. He is the one that describes, for the first time, a new covenant, a new relationship founded in the heart. Ezekiel has his own way, speaking as the pastor to this sort of motley crew of refugees in Babylon about going back. And so the other side of that shed here, you'll see that, and you see that in Jeremiah, because that here, at the moment, you see that the very moment, or you see that in Ezekiel, the transition from the destruction has come. And for Jeremiah, that destruction was deserved. We earned it. Careful with that, because that's been used against the Jews around the world. But Jeremiah then begins to sing the message of faithfulness and hope and redemption. And if Heschel is right, every major prophet, the ones he talks about here, ends it with a message of hope. Because what we have to deal here with is overwhelming compassion of God for all of God's people. And the prophets are not primarily predictors. I want to put that in before I pick up these scenes from Heschel and that. In a popular sort of sense that you have these sort of words that are sorted there, and all of a sudden they point to something in the future. Most of the prophecies of the prophets didn't come true. And Brother Concern, most of the prophets here, and Heschel talks about that a great deal, they want change. They want repentance. They want you to turn around. And if God has promised destruction, and if you turn around, God will change his mind. And that the words of God can always be changed. The compassion of God, according to prophets, cannot. You have a different kind of prophecy in Daniel, and that's what with the classical prophets, most of their, and they did a lot of predicting, in the sense, this will happen, but it's always, if unless you change your ways, we'll have that passage in Jeremiah, unless you amend your ways, this will come. And true, most of the time they didn't amend their ways, and the destruction came. And that's why later on these words prove so true, because exactly what the prophet said came to true. But there's always that big if there, and the great prophet. And the message of the prophets in heart is not one of sort of you can look into the future. The prophets were not seers that could have looked into the future, or there were those around at a time that could look into chicken entrails and predict, you know, like a kind of, you know, a sort of fancy thing of predicting the future. They had nothing to do with that. In fact, the prophets' most harsh words come against, quote, the prophets. We'll see in Amos, when we look at that tomorrow, when he confronts here the priest at Bethel, I'm not a prophet. Is that the kind that you have in mind? Nor am I a prophet's son. He's not a part of the guild of the prophets. And the harshest words of the prophets that we have recorded were against those that called themselves prophets. And so you have the tension that they were God's servants, the prophets. But most of the time he's saying the bad word is about the prophets, because what they wanted to do, they wanted to make the people feel happy. You have these marvelous words in Jeremiah, not marvelous, terrible words in Jeremiah, for example. And these were people who were faithful to the promises of the previous prophet Isaiah, that God will not abandon Jerusalem. That's what Isaiah said. Isaiah, no, that one prediction didn't come true. God would not abandon Jerusalem. But on a sense it did. And so you had all these people and prophets saying, nothing can go wrong, nothing can go wrong, nothing can go wrong. You're wrong. These false prophets are calling peace, peace, when there is no peace. And so typical of the prophets, life is rotten. There is destruction that are around us. And the nation, in that case Jerusalem, is going to go down the tubes. And you have the prophet say, we are God's people, we are safe, we are secure. And Jeremiah, like others, say there is no security. As you understand that. And so there's that complex thing. What manner of man is the prophet? Let me share some things from Heschel. In that introduction and some themes here, I put them down here and comment on each of those. And And so again, stop me, because mainly we're going to deal with the text, but this sort of set the stage for what I'm going to do. I quoted before, that's on the sheet here, this is the book about the most disturbing people who have ever lived, and I would agree with that. The men who brought the inspiration, brought the Bible into being. The men, sometimes women, whose image is our refuge in distress, whose voice and vision sustain our faith. By the way, Heschel's book here is dedicated to his Jewish friends. Let me quote that. I have that. Survived the Holocaust. Okay? To read Heschel is to know, you need to know something about the Holocaust, in which 6 or more million Jews, including many children, were destroyed. And this is also a book that speaks out of the experience of the Holocaust. And it's a quotation from the Psalms. And my greatest colleague at Augustana was an Orthodox Jew who had become a Lutheran, but he still remained an Orthodox Jew. And he was next door to me, and he loved the Psalms. All this has come upon us, though we have not forgotten thee, or been false to thy covenant. Our heart has not turned back, nor have our steps departed from thy way. For thy sake we are slain. Why dost thou hide thy face? Dedicated to his people who were demolished in the Holocaust. Another part of the Jewish cry. For the prophets are certain about God and God's will, at least at the surface. But there is a great element of Jewish piety, accurately thought, that they had been faithful, that they had fulfilled their part in the partnership with God, and God had abandoned them. If we're out of time, I take another book, and the writing is called Lamentations. Sometimes it's called the Lamentations of Jeremiah, but they're probably not by Jeremiah. To express here, at the scene, at the moment, the anguish and the struggle to understand why God, who is compassion and faithfulness, has abandoned them. Come to Jeremiah, we'll pick up these themes as well. Because as mentioned to somebody as we're drinking coffee beforehand, Jeremiah is a remarkable book. We have the writing process of Amos. We have essentially their oracles, their statements, their public preaching, and usually in finely crafted poetry. In Jeremiah, we have three levels that enter into the prophet. We have the words of Jeremiah. Here is the person who is totally obedient and faithful and clear and fervent. And then, and that's the text that we'll look at, we have what we call the Confessions of Jeremiah. Sort of like diaries, they're never intended to be published. In which he hates God, he hates his people, and he's torn in between them. He curses God for giving him this impossible task. The same man that was like sort of a head of steel. Jeremiah ought to come to teach Jeremiah, you wear a helmet. And if you teach Ezekiel, you wear a helmet here with diamonds on it, or adamant on that, something very hard stone that would be there. Because God, the prophet complained, God, these people don't hear what I have to say. They're hard on me. They'll destroy me. And God says, I'll give you a steel helmet, or a helmet of metal, or bronze, I think it is, or you'll have the helmet of adamant or diamond. But back to Jeremiah. We also have Jeremiah's sidekick, Baruch, who describes these things, and marvelous stories. Jeremiah confronts here, the king, and the contempt for the king has that Jeremiah comes before him, and he is humiliated, and he's humiliated in front of his people. And so you have that three levels of looking at the prophet. And so I would say that because the supreme source here, that all of this is drawn from these prophets of just 200 some years. But Jeremiah is exhibit A of what the prophet is, because Jeremiah is overwhelmingly the prophet of the heart of inwardness. Where were we? On that. Some things we've said before, the prophet is a person, not a microphone. I think that. as we begin, because we've had the tradition in the Protestant circle that the prophet is simply the spokesperson for the words of God. Or even another version of it in the scholarly world, the prophet is simply the messenger, that he prepares God's message. Sort of, you have the message of something out here, and then it sort of comes to the prophet. The prophet embodies that message, becomes a part of his life or her life. And that life, therefore, is important. So what the prophet is as important as well as what the prophet's message is that is there. Part of the power of the word that's not his own. And one thing that's clear, without exception, the prophets are saying, and they seem rather arrogant to the outsider, the listener, this is not my word. And most of the time they're speaking, thus says Yahweh, thus says the Lord. If anybody said that in our time, we would not take them seriously in America or many places. They would try to lock them up and kill them. I mean, nobody speaks on behalf of God because nobody has that right in our society. That's just your opinion, you say that. And the prophets have that audacity, that sense of certainty, as they've indicated, each prophet will have its own individuality, and this is why I want to take the prophets along the way. The intention... Heschel talks about getting into the consciousness of the prophet, but we'll do that by practicing and later in. But some other quotes. The situation of a person, because what I want to have us deal with in these sessions is our situation, and the prophets and us, and this is why Heschel became so powerful for me. The situation of a person immersed in the prophet's words is one of being exposed to a ceaseless shattering of indifference. I think I said in the last session, the primary sin is callousness or indifference. And when it comes connected with authority, it is the most destructive force that is around. And one needs the skull of stone to remain callous to such blows. And so if you're coming to the prophets, be prepared for an exciting but rather unpleasant experience, because all of a sudden it'll be obvious when we deal with Amos that Amos is speaking to us. And one of the fun in the beginning with Amos, you don't need much translation, because what Amos talks about, it's like Amos walked off the street and he was describing the U.S. today. 2,700 years haven't changed the way people relate to people in terms of power. And so with Amos, that is easy indeed. Thus, in the course of listening to their words, one cannot long retain the sense of security of a prudent and impartial observer. Much of Heschel's two-volume book is an argument with the scholars in many traditions around the world, in which religion is understood and sort of that sense of detachment. And we have, even more, we've understood God is the God who is sort of without feeling, without pain, without hurt, who is sort of distant. And the Jews and Christians have bought into that tradition that is not the God of the prophets. The prophets do not offer reflections about ideas in general. Their words are onslaughts, scudding illusions of false security, challenging evasions, calling faith to account, questioning prudence and impartiality. One would be equally afraid to submit to their strange certainties. They're dangerous things, and anybody this certain, you be careful. And to resist their tremendous claims because of incredulity or impotence of spirit. Reflection about the prophets gives way to communion with the prophets. And I said that was my experience. Not only ideas of who they were, or what their message is, but here I had lifelong, strange, and difficult conversational partners that I had to live with. Pure reflection makes the decision for the clarification of what prophets' consciousness asserts, but not for what the experience existence involves. For such understanding, and that's a key word for Heschel, it is not enough to have the prophets in mind. We must think as if we're inside their minds. For them to be alive and present to us, we must think not about, but in the prophets, with their concern and their heart. Their existence involves us. And that's what I want to do today and the other sessions that you may wish to come, to get somehow into the prophets, an individual prophet, to go through their words, to use your imagination. In the moments that remain,
I wanted to take some of these themes that are found in Heschel and that chapter that sort of transformed my life. And I find rings those through to the text. The prophet is one who is sensitive to evil. The prophet is thin-skinned. His focus is upon evil. That's why you won't have Robert Schuller doing much of that, because it is bad news. Mm-hmm. Over 90% of the text here are painful texts. They may be beautifully written in terms of poetry, tremendous in images in terms of Isaiah, but they confront and they deal with what Heschel calls the slums. Philosophers want to take you to the palaces, to the quiet mountains of Holden Village. But prophets brings you to the slums where children are dying and widows don't survive. They deal with trivialities. Because one widow does not have the livelihood to survive according to the prophets. And many of them say something like this: the whole plan of God goes down the tube. The nation will fall. The little stuff counts. What's that new book called out, you know?
It's all little stuff.
Well, the prophet, the other way, the little stuff is what counts on that. This is one of my favorites about the language, and that is so true. Their language is not to inform or to illuminate, but it burns, it scorches. It's luminous, explosive. It is offensive. And somebody ought to translate language in my language, because you would lose the language of the street in those terms on that, because this is not polite language of the drawing room that is there. And it is powerful language, even when it is in poetry, especially when it is in poetry. Another one, I put the asterisk here, the highest good. The view of the prophets have a very different view that we have sort of inherited in the Western world about the highest good. A wealth and health and wisdom, power. There's a passage we'll pick up in Jeremiah along that point. A very different thing about the fundamental values by which we live. That run counter not only to modern times, but the great tradition of Greek and Roman, and therefore Jewish and Christian traditions. All this has been a minor voice within our circles. They speak in an octave too high, or another way of saying their voices are very shrill. You wouldn't want to be around these guys, because I think, you know, they would grate on your nerves. They're screaming, they're hollering. Their voice is sort of nauseating and that sort of thing, and they're just sort of so impatient and so angry. And especially angry because they think they are sort of expressing the anger of God. And they probably are. And so they speak in an octave that's not too loud, sort of disturbs us. That's the iconoclast. What is an iconoclast? One who smashes images. And the prophets offend everybody, including us. You get an Amos and then you'll throw the book down, because that's too disturbing for me. It is not only the rulers. You know, the early prophets are sort of knocked on the rulers on that. Not only the priests, which most of us like to do with the religious establishment, but it comes down, we see that in Amos, down the road, you know, these fat cows of Bashan here, these women who live in luxury because their husbands have this sort of deal with the sweetheart deals and their sort of stuff, they do it. And those of you who don't even care. And so they attack the ordinary people. I mean, they're not demagogues in that sense, because the very people the demagogues would sort of play up to, the prophet sort of dismissed as well. Austerity and compassion. Heschel argues that the fundamental thing of the prophet is compassion. God is a God of compassion, and the prophets share that as well. I think that's another one I like, exaggeration. Don't take the prophets literally. I mean, most of their words are so exaggerated, so outlandish. And sort of people, sort of Bible thumpers, will take the Bible and take these sorts of words and put a code to them, and there's something in the future. I mean, literally, and they're not true. But Heschel says, they point to that part of the truth because you speak about the anger and the compassion and the concern and the urgency that is there, and you understand in that time. Jesus sort of humorously said, you know, you're so zealous about the laws, you strain out the flies in your milk and then you drink the camels. I mean, nobody would do that, and you don't think about that literally, but we tend to take scriptural words literally, and the prophets are awfully hard to take literally, even in English, let alone Hebrew on that.
everybody's responsible. We're not talking about that. Amos will be that and more, and nobody gets off the hook. I mean, not, you just have to start pointing the things. And the book of Amos begins, he goes around the circle of the nations of their violence to the innocent people there. And finally he ends up with Judah, and he's preaching here and now in Israel and Bethel, and all of a sudden it's you. And then he goes down and everybody there. I mean, there's nobody that can escape. I mean, guilt is something that's sort of corporate, and you know, responsibility, and I get a blast from heaven. This is a divine power. And there's nothing quite like that in religious literature. That sort of things of God is sort of angry and sort of coming at the people and the prophet as a vehicle for that. As I mentioned earlier, the thing that the prophets are against is callousness or indifference is the primary human sin. And when it is combined with authority, with power, then it is the most destructive force. And much of their words are speaking about that. And much of the prophetic words, and many of them, are speaking about politics. And then where you have that thing, church politics and good politics, we'll cut off in a moment quickly. The prophet is not lonely because he is with God, but he shares the misery of God, if you can imagine that. The great miracle of the prophets, he said, is that the people tolerated them at all. The greatest thing you can say about people, Heschel says, that our people allowed the prophets to speak. They killed a lot of them, they silenced a lot of them, but they later recorded their voices and gone back to them again and again. And that is the great miracle of God, and that's why we have scripture. Who is the prophet in the summary? He is an assayer, a good word to use here, with a copper mine in our distance, who determined the presence of valuable metals, a messenger, but the prophet is much more than a messenger. Primarily the prophet is a witness who incarnates the anger and the wrath as well as the compassion of God. And then finally, and the whole book proceeds from that, the prophet experiences what Heschel calls the pathos, the deep concern of God. God is not a God with an idea or a power or reality primarily, but God is feeling. Feeling that includes pain and suffering. And that's an idea that our Western tradition has sort of put down. And then to respond to that, the prophet is unique to these great figures because they are enabled, and hopefully we in a small way are able to respond to that depth of feeling in terms of sympathy, that pain and that suffering and that compassion and that love that is appropriate to God's pathos or feeling. That's the end of the show, and we'll break here so they cut the tape, but if you want to...